and welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health podcast, which is on the topic of direct oral anticoagulants in the treatment of cancer-related venous thromboembolism. Joining us to explore this subject is two experts in the field, Dr. Mark Carrier and Dr. Harry Gibbs. They will each be discussing patient cases of this disease. This podcast is brought to you by an educational grant from Pfizer. I will now pass over to Dr. Carrier and Dr. Gibbs. Over to you both to please introduce yourselves and begin the podcast.
I'm Mark Carrier. I'm one of the hematologists in Ottawa, Canada. I do mostly venous thrombosis for a living. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, I'm Harry Gibbs. I'm a vascular and general physician in Melbourne, Australia, and I do a lot of thrombosis, but then I do some other more general internal medicine and cardiology. And likewise, it's a pleasure to be here. Mark, I'm currently on ward service at my hospital, and I saw a patient this week with a cancer-associated thrombosis, and I wanted to see what you thought about this lady. So she's a lady in her mid-60s who about 4 months ago actually was found to have an anaplastic ependymoma of the cerebellum. Now, I'm not an oncologist, but anything that says anaplastic sounds bad to me. And she had this tumor resected, and a couple of weeks after that developed headache and had a CT scan and then an MR, both of which showed that she had a cerebral sinus thrombosis. So she was commenced initially on low molecular heparin, and then the neurosurgeons involved wanted her to be treated with warfarin, their rationale being that it can be reversed. And she's now had about 3 months of warfarin therapy. She actually came in with an unrelated problem. And as an aside for the medical students on the team, she had fantastic cerebellar physical signs with dysdiadochokinesis and past pointing of the finger-nose test. Which was pretty exciting for all of us, actually. But anyway, the questions that cropped up were, firstly, it shows that there is a strong association between malignancies and the development of thrombosis. And in fact, there's a very strong association with central nervous system tumors. And really, the question is this a provoked episode of venous thrombosis provoked by surgery, in which case you might say that she should receive 3 months of anticoagulation? Or is this a cancer-associated thrombosis precipitated by the cancer, in which case you could say that she should receive treatment for indefinitely? And in fact, you would say that she should not have warfarin as her treatment. So they were the questions that we discussed on our ward round, and I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, it's a fantastic case. And may I ask, there's no signs of the disease elsewhere. So this was a resection and hopefully she's now clear of underlying cancer. Is she undergoing other additional treatment?
She's just started radiotherapy.
So it's a nice case because there's no right answers. And as you pointed out, different tumor types will have different underlying risk of having venous thromboembolic event. And often primary brain tumors are associated with really high risk, and they're really challenging because when they need anticoagulation, independent of the type of anticoagulation we need or that we start, these patients would be at high risk of bleeding complication. That probably led to a discussion for sure among your team about IV unfractionated heparin or low MAC weight heparin upon initiation of anticoagulation. And that led to the preference of your surgeon to use vitamin K antagonist, which is totally, totally reasonable. Cerebral vein thrombosis are rare, but you sort of almost feel like, you know, there is, of course, a major risk factor with the underlying malignancy, but it almost feels like there's an additional transient major risk factor with the surgery. And therefore, should we consider underlying risk of having a recurrence after the initial 3 months of anticoagulation to be back where it would be for any other type of patients, i.e. would she deserve maybe primary prevention or secondary prevention? Or do we feel comfortable that this is related to the underlying tumor as well, and therefore she needs to remain on some form of therapeutic dose of anticoagulation for longer for secondary prevention? Is a very intriguing question. You would argue almost that if her clot was in the lower extremity or in the pulmonary arteries, she would be the type of patients that would have been randomized into the different trials, even if she had had surgery. And these trials would argue that you need to have at least 6 months in that setting in order to make sure that the risk of recurrence is no longer very high afterwards. But admittedly, it's different because she also had an important transient major risk factor, which is very close to where her clot is, putting a little bit more emphasis on the fact that maybe they are related or not. So again, there's no right or wrong answer. If it's still undergoing radiation therapy and there's still underlying cancer treatment, I would probably err on the side of continuing anticoagulation and reassessing after a total duration of 6 months to see where she's at. It's never been published, but I saw a small abstract at ASH 1 year from a French study that looked at patient that had cancer-associated thrombosis, but also in the context of having another major transient risk factor like surgery, and followed patients over time and tried to look at the risk of recurrence beyond the initial 3 months to see if it was where you would expect it to be after a major transient risk factor only. But it seemed to be higher. And at that time, the investigators saying, well, even if there's a major transient risk factor on top of cancer-associated thrombosis, maybe 6 months is the right duration before we stratify patients further.
So I'll tell you what I decided to do. So firstly, the question is what anticoagulant is most appropriate. And I understand the neurosurgeon's concerns about bleeding. I always feel, however, that the outcome of someone who has a bleed whilst they're on an intracranial hemorrhage, whilst they're on warfarin, is terrible. And the outcome is usually determined before they arrive at hospital and before the warfarin can be reversed. So I think really the neurosurgeons are giving themselves some comfort that probably shouldn't be there. And the next thing is that I'm slightly lucky in that I'm meeting her at 3 months and she hasn't had any bleeding. So the rate of bleeding with anticoagulants is highest early in treatment. And once you get out to 3 months, if you haven't bled, you're probably not going to. Well, the rate becomes, yeah, it's certainly higher than those not on anticoagulants, but it's still, you know, quite acceptably low. So I decided firstly to change her to a DOAC at this point. So we stopped warfarin and commenced apixaban. And I've kept her on a therapeutic dose of apixaban, so 5 milligrams twice daily. And as you suggest, I'm going to continue that for another 3 months, which takes her out to 6 months of therapy. And at that point, I will probably continue it, actually, but I'll see how she is. And it depends a little whether she's had recurrence of a tumor and so on, and what her feelings about taking tablets are and those things. But the next question then, and I know that you're involved in a trial about this, is whether it's feasible at that point, at the 6 month mark, to reduce the dose to 2.5 milligrams twice daily, as we would normally do in a non-cancer associated thrombosis, if extended therapy was going to be used. Is it reasonable to do that in someone with cancer, or do we have to wait for the trial data, which will be coming one of these years?
Firstly, I would like to say I completely agree with what you said about the vitamin K antagonists and somewhat the false reassurance that you can manage bleeding. An intracranial bleed, independent on the type of anticoagulation, is associated with a bad outcome. And probably the most important thing is to prevent bleeding. And we know that low microarray heparin or direct oral anticoagulant are certainly associated with less risk of intracranial hemorrhage compared to vitamin K antagonists because you don't have the fluctuation of the INRs and it's easier to make sure that they have proper dosing, which could be weight adjusted if it's low microarray heparin or just a single, you know, single dose direct oral anticoagulant. I wouldn't let the fact that it's a cerebral vein thrombosis get me overly too excited. We know there's little data to begin with anticoagulation for cerebral vein thrombosis. One randomized trial compared after 5 to 10 days of parenteral anticoagulation, warfarin to dabigatran, and showed no recurrent VTE and good bleeding profile with folks receiving a direct anticoagulant, that particular risk of dabigatran. And now there's over 600 cases of reported cerebral vein thrombosis treated with DOAC in the literature, and they seem to be just as good as vitamin K. So I would have done the same because it's easier for the patient. You have, as you mentioned, the risk of bleeding is relatively small. We want to continue anticoagulation for 6 months. And then assuming that the cancer is still present and still ongoing treatment, then your question is, we need to continue anticoagulation, of course. Is it okay to decrease the dose to a prophylactic dose or continue therapeutic? And as you mentioned, there's two randomized controlled trials looking at that particular issue. They're both looking at apixaban, and they're randomizing patients to therapeutic at 5 BID or 2.5 BID. And therefore, since we feel comfortable randomizing patients, there's obviously no right answer. The answer that we have so far is that therapeutic or intermediate dosing of anticoagulation seems to be reasonable, because there's two prospective cohort studies without control, single arm studies looking at therapeutic or intermediate dose low-molecular-weight heparin for a year after the initial diagnosis. So beyond the initial 6 months, by another 6 months, and the data is showing that the risk of recurrence remains relatively high. Despite anticoagulation, the risk of bleeding is small. So indirect evidence saying it's probably reasonable. And then if you look at the post-hoc analysis of Okusai VTE cancer that followed patients for 12 months, we know that edoxaban at therapeutic dose at 60 seemed to be effective and safe in that setting. But it begs the question, and we know these patients are associated with a higher risk of bleeding, especially in your patient. Can we decrease the dose a little bit? And because, as mentioned, there's randomized controlled trials, so there's clearly clinical equipoise on this. And I used to be a believer that we should continue these patients on higher dosing, thinking that they're high risk of recurrence. But when I look at the data for primary prevention and I looked at the on-treatment analysis, and we're now extrapolating a little bit because we don't have data, but we're extrapolating from patients that receive primary prevention with a DOAC, let's say apixaban 2.5 BID versus placebo, and you look at the on-treatment analysis, meaning looking just at the event that happened while people were taking the tablets, the hazard ratio is 0.92. So it seems to be very effective for primary prevention if the patients are compliant with the tablets. So now it led me to have a reflection. Well, am I getting a whole lot more by pushing the dose to 5 milligrams? And we know in the primary prevention setting, compared to placebo anyway, this is already associated with a high risk of bleeding. So I'm not sure if the therapeutic dosing is necessary as much as I thought it was beforehand. So I don't have a great answer, but I'm certainly more open to dose reduction in these patients, especially if I'm concerned with bleeding, because I think I'm hopeful that the 2.5, for example, of apixaban would be good enough for secondary prevention in that setting.
Yeah, so first of all, philosophically, I'm an anticoagulator. So I tend to favor anticoagulation over not anticoagulation. So the extended duration trials in non-cancer associated VTE have made me have a very low threshold to offer the patients extended duration treatment. So after an initial course of 3 to 6 months of full therapeutic dosing, then I would usually reduce to either 2.5 milligrams twice daily of apixaban or 10 milligrams once daily of rivaroxaban and continue that long term, with the exception of patients who have had episodes of venous thrombosis that have occurred following surgery or major trauma. Most other patients I would offer extended duration treatment to. The trials are interesting, I think, in that the efficacy was pretty similar, so that the lower dose seemed to work pretty much as well as the higher dose. But the thing that I found interesting was that there wasn't much difference in bleeding, so that the two large randomized controlled trials looking at this showed that there was a bit of a reduction in clinically relevant non-major bleeding, but major bleeding was rare. Very rare, actually. And in fact, in the apixaban trial, it was slightly numerically less than the group who received placebo, which is, I guess, strange. But anyway, I tend to try and use the lowest dose possible of any drug. So I do tend to reduce the dose. But really, I think that the trials in some ways show that you almost don't have to, because the change in bleeding is really very small. How do you interpret those trials?
In a very similar way. But I think, as you mentioned, it is important to have more data specifically in the setting of cancer, because things are changing and they may be at higher risk of bleeding. So who knows what it will show. But probably both, as you mentioned, both treatment regimen are probably very effective and safe to do so. Will we be able to see any difference, you know, clinically important difference between the two? We don't know, but it may be very similar to the results in the non-cancer patient population for standard prevention.
I'd agree with you. I mean, I think the cancer group are quite different in that, firstly, they have more recurrences in spite of anticoagulant therapy, far more than non-cancer patients, but also they have more bleeding than non-cancer patients. So both sides of the risk-benefit equation stacked against or are worse, if you like, in the cancer group. So we do need to have some data. The way that the balance might turn out to be might actually be different than in the non-cancer group. So I think it's a very important trial and be very interesting. I had another topic I wanted to talk to you about, actually, and that's about incidental VTE. And so we see a lot of that now, particularly for cancer staging, and in particular, it's incidental pulmonary embolism, which is found during a CT scan of the chest, usually performed for staging. And the question arises as to what should be done about that. But I know, again, you've done some work looking at this, which I found pretty interesting. So a couple of things. The first is, when we find incidental pulmonary embolism on a scan, can we be confident that it's pulmonary embolism?
You're right. It's the first question we should ask ourselves, right? Because this was a non-dedicated CT scan. It was meant to look at other things, and therefore the contrast was not timed to light up the pulmonary arteries. And what's the sensitivity and specificity is actually not really well known at all. And it may be worse as we get to smaller and smaller pulmonary arteries, and therefore maybe worthwhile if you're having a single segmental or subsegmental incidental PEs made on CT staging. I usually go to the radiologist and review the imaging with him or her just to see, to make sure that it's not artifactual in nature, there's no concerns. And if there are concerns, then I tend to repeat imaging just to confirm it, to rule it out, because this is not a small decision. As we previously mentioned, these patients will likely be on lifelong anticoagulation with potential risk of bleeding, and therefore it's worthwhile confirming the diagnosis with radiologists. But I think for large pulmonary artery thromboses, then I usually feel comfortable initiating anticoagulation. And often when I talk to patients, they have symptoms, and they have symptoms that they thought it was because of their underlying tumor or risk, you know, a side effect of their chemotherapy. They didn't really know, because there's not a lot of awareness of thrombosis in the setting of cancer. They didn't even know they could have a PE, and therefore often they have some symptoms as well. So I'm not sure what your thoughts are about the diagnosis, what you do clinically, but I think for some of these incidental clots, especially in very small pulmonary arteries, it's worthwhile going down to the radiology department and having a chat with our colleagues.
Yeah, that's what I do. I mean, I think that I like to treat the patient and not the x-ray, but I know I see a lot of kind of the junior staff actually who, I mean, the technology is fantastic, but they believe it a bit too much. And if it's not in keeping with the clinical features that the patient has, you have to question whether it's artifactual. So I do exactly what you say and go and talk to the radiologists. And there have been some studies that have looked at inter-observer variability with, as you mentioned, subsegmental pulmonary embolism, and it's really quite high. So one radiologist will say it's a pulmonary embolus, another one will say that it's artifactual. And it is a big decision because, you know, as we've just discussed, you might be prescribing an anticoagulant for life, potentially, for these patients. And that might be fine in the short term. But then when you get to the point where they start to have some bleeding complication, you go down a difficult road of thinking about IVC filters and all sorts of things. And so you really want to be certain that you know what you're treating, I think. But I did see that you've performed a systematic review on this topic, and the recurrence rate was a bit less in those receiving anticoagulants with incidental VTE compared to those who had symptomatic non-incidental VTE, which in some ways is kind of might be explained by what we're talking about, and that some of them might not have had an episode of pulmonary embolism in the first place. But the other thing that I found really fascinating about that was that the bleeding rate was higher. So why might you have more bleeding in someone with an incidental PE compared to someone who has a non-incidental PE?
Well, we don't know, right? As you mentioned, this was just to highlight an important knowledge gap about the risk of recurrence despite anticoagulation, but also the bleeding complication. As you mentioned, it showed that the risk of recurrence is lower for incidental compared to symptomatic. They're still relatively high despite anticoagulation, so most of them need to be treated, of course, and it may be explained by what we discussed. From a bleeding perspective, it's a little harder and more puzzling. It may be related to the type of patients that tend to get more CT scan for staging, and often patients with gastrointestinal type of tumors often have a lot of CT scans for restaging. It's a type of tumor that is highly prevalent as well. And we know that with anticoagulation, sometimes these tumors may be at higher risk of bleeding complication, at least early on, especially if it's unresected in nature. So maybe these are important to maybe the differences in bleeding may be related to baseline characteristics, and we would need to have individual patient data in order to see if there's big differences between those that have incidental versus symptomatic event. And if so, then could that be explaining the differences we're seeing overall, I think? Do you tend to treat them in a very similar way?
Yeah, I do. So I would give them a course of anticoagulation for a period of time, 3 to 6 months. And then at the end of that time, if they have a clear, you know, symptomatic episode of pulmonary embolism, for example, I would continue anticoagulants long term. But in this group of incidental ones, I try and decide in my mind how likely I think it was that they actually had an episode of pulmonary embolism, which can be difficult. And then I look at their pill burden, their philosophy about how much treatments they want to have, their bleeding risk, their inconvenience, and all those sorts of things, and then sometimes continue and sometimes stop. But it's a group where I certainly will consider stopping anticoagulants at the 3 to 6 month mark. I had a colleague rang me during the week about a patient with myositis, not a cancer, but this patient had a myositis and had recurrent venous thrombosis, which actually had occurred in spite of therapeutic anticoagulation. So an interesting case, a difficult case, but it raises the issue that inflammation is associated with venous thrombosis. So we know that myositis is associated with venous thrombosis, in particular inflammatory bowel disease is, but any other inflammatory condition is associated with an increase in venous thrombosis. So the approach to cancer these days is to use checkpoint inhibitors, which deliberately lead to inflammation, with the benefit being that they, you notice that you've got a cancer and decide to try and attack it. But the side effects being, in particular, that you may develop inflammatory problems in other organ systems. So what about VTE? To what extent do checkpoint inhibitors and the inflammation that they lead to increase your risk of VTE? And is there an argument for prophylactic doses of anticoagulants, DOACs or low molecular weight heparin, for example, in patients receiving certain checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah, it's a fantastic point, because anti-cancer treatment is evolving over time. And it's probably evolving too quickly for clinical trials. And we're talking about checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy, all sorts of new agents are coming down and being really incorporated into standard of care for a lot of different type of tumors. And we don't necessarily understand the underlying risk of VTE, because these are poorly captured in cancer trials. They're often using a classification for adverse events that doesn't really incorporate VTE, or the way we like to think about VTE, in a very good way. So the reporting of this as being a potential adverse event or serious adverse event is probably diluted out within the different AEs that are reported. And again, when we do intervention with primary thromboprophylaxis in that setting, you know, is it effective or not? Is it providing the best risk-benefit ratio is a little bit unclear. And the way we stratify patients according to, for example, their tumor type or any form of any risk prediction score that we use for primary prevention in cancer, we're not sure if it actually works for patients that are taking these different medicines, right? Or these different anti-cancer treatment, because it really hasn't been validated too much. There's no doubt, as you mentioned, that when you do systematic review, and there's a recent one from Su-Fei Wang and colleagues, that it seems to be associated with a higher risk. Is it the same additional risk factors that we often think about that would put the risk further is possible? But it might be something to keep in mind for future trials, I think, to keep in mind that there's not only the cancer-related risk factors, but inflammation-related risk factors as well, and that might be exponential over time. What are your thoughts on that?
I guess from a practical point of view, you know, one of the questions that comes up is whether they should have primary prophylaxis. And I don't think really we have identified a cohort of patients who have a risk that's sufficient to warrant that, because, you know, unlike surgical prophylaxis, they're going to be on the prophylaxis for a long period of time, and it complicates the other aspects of their treatment. So, you know, I think it's a really important area. It would be great to be able to have a risk score, and there are risk scores, but one that is predictive enough of, you know, that teases out a subgroup that clearly need to have prophylaxis. But I don't think we're quite there yet. That's one thing. And the second is that, you know, you have to have a pretty high index of suspicion for venous thrombosis in cancer patients, because, as you know, the incidence of cancers, you know, 5 to 10% per annum. The incidence of VTE in cancer patients is, you know, at least is more than 5% per annum, and they have a lifetime risk of, you know, more than 20% of developing VTE during complicating their cancer. You know, it's a very common complication. So you just need to be thinking about it carefully.
And arterial thrombosis too, right? Because the systematic review that I was referring to, as you highlighted, ported a 5 to 8% at 6 months and 10% at 12-month risk of having VTE for all comers receiving a checkpoint inhibitors. But there is also a 1 to 5% risk of arterial events at 12 months. So your index suspicion for both venous and arterial thromboses need to be low and investigate as needed.
Do you think there'll be some biomarkers that might help us predict those who are at a greater risk of developing thrombotic complications of cancer therapies?
I think so. I think a number of biomarkers have been tried with P-selectin, and the biomarkers that we readily have available would be like CBC parameters and D-dimers, and they're somewhat helpful, but not very sensitive or specific. Other like tissue factor, P-selectin, GP15, all of these things have been looked at, and they can be helpful, but they're often validated in samples from randomized control trials, and they haven't been used yet to make a decision about initiation of thromboprophylaxis or not. And more importantly, they're not readily available. And if you read different biomarkers, they have different methodologies, and therefore sometimes it's a kit, but sometimes it's an in-house assay. So it's standardization is a big problem, I think. But studies are ongoing, and eventually I think we'll be able to stratify patients further. And it might be through genomics as well, not only biomarkers that are functional, but maybe we'll be able to, through proteomics and other things, find things that we can really stratify patients accordingly, but not just yet, because it's not readily available for clinicians like you and I.
I had one other case that I saw in the clinic this week. So this was an interesting case. This is not a man with cancer. He'd had trauma, and that had been complicated by pulmonary embolism. And because we're still locked down here in Melbourne, I saw him by telehealth. And when I spoke to him, his first comment was about being vaccinated against COVID, which he said he was an anti-vaxxer. And he told me that this was, you know, a fascist plot, which wasn't a good start to the consultation. And then when I asked him how his anticoagulant therapy was, he told me that he didn't take it because it had surfactant, which would kill him. So we didn't get very far, actually. But and it concerned me a bit because he did have pulmonary embolism. But anyway, I guess he's an extreme example. But many, many patients will ask whether there are natural things that they can do or complementary things in addition to anticoagulants that are going to reduce their risk of, in particular, recurrent VTE. And that's maybe more so in the cancer group than in the non-cancer group, where people, you know, really do want to have something which is going to help their outcome that they can do for themselves. So what do you think? I mean, do you think that there is any worthwhile advice around a diet, for example, that might have some supposedly anti-inflammatory action that might reduce thrombosis, or meditation, or any other ancillary approaches that might be useful for the patients?
I usually use the VTE as a good time to reset your, you know, what you do for your general health. And I often take a few minutes with patients to have a discussion. So, for example, for hypercholesterolemia, there's a small link between maybe taking an anti-cholesterol medication like a statin and the risk of recurrence, for example. There's randomized control trial ongoing. So I let them know that the risks or that the links are relatively weak, but if they're concerned about having another recurrence, then weight reduction might be desirable. If they are obese, changing their diet to try to minimize, or having a similar cardiac-friendly diet might be a good thing, to decrease or stop smoking if required, and to keep active as the most important things, and to try to move as much as possible. That there's no danger for clots to extend or travel. They often have these weird thoughts that maybe by doing too much, they can lead to recurrent events. So I reassure them from that point of view. But I don't necessarily give them or prescribe them medication, but I try to highlight that this is, you know, a red flag or something that happened, and it's important for them to take ownership of their health in general. What do you do?
Yeah, so more or less that. I mean, if they specifically ask for many of them ask about dietary advice, and there's a couple of, you know, suggestions in the literature that having a diet, a healthy diet, reduces your risk of venous thrombosis. Although, of course, the science isn't very strong, but it seems like good general advice to tell people to have more fruit and vegetables and less fried food and processed meats, and maybe to eat a bit more fish. So I tell them to do that. I tell them to try and maintain their ideal body weight and to exercise. For the management of stress, I do tell them that whilst we don't know if there's a benefit in terms of their overall health, that meditation helps some people, exercise helps some people, yoga help some people cope better with their illness, and, you know, can help reduce some of the, you know, negative thoughts and stressful thoughts that they have. Whether that translates into a health benefit or not, we really don't know. Certainly, you know, psychosocial stress is a significant risk factor for cardiovascular events, and I think we have less data about its effect on venous thrombosis. But it's an interesting topic, but chronic stress is associated with increased activity of the amygdala. And there was a very interesting study, a PET study, looking at cardiac events that showed that increased amygdala activity was associated with increased bone marrow activity and increased arterial inflammation, suggesting a link between stress and cardiovascular events. But of course, one of the changes with acute stress is an increase in thrombosis. It's an evolutionary benefit. You know, I mean, if the tiger comes out and actually manages to attack you, well, the first thing you need to do is stop bleeding. So there is an increase in thrombosis, but whether doing things to reduce stress reduces it, we really don't know. But it always seems like a kind of a sensible thing, particularly for those who ask, because if they're asking, they're thinking about it, and I can see very little harm. And so, it seems to me it validates a little bit their concern and offers them some sort of hope, perhaps. Yeah, so that's Absolutely. What I do. It's a fascinating area, actually.
Absolutely.
And that concludes today's podcast. A huge thanks to Dr. Carrier and Dr. Gibbs for their time and for sharing those wonderful case studies with us, as well as all their expertise with our audience. To all of our listeners, we hope you found today's discussion and case studies of interest and value. Thank you for listening. Take care and listen out for the next EMG Health podcast. We release a new episode every Friday. Goodbye for now.